Ty James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life! Life, do you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered the restricted broadcast area. You have entered the restricted broadcast.
Your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
You betcha. Guy James here once again, and so glad to be with you here today, coming to you from the blue waters and sandy beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida. And all around the world, glad to have everybody along with us today. My goodness, it's amazing here on the Head On Radio Network. We've got people listening, I know for a fact, just got some email from Great Britain and South Korea. But I mean, people everywhere, and people right next door as well. So that's a good thing. Glad to have all of you along with us today. A lot to talk about on the show today. We're going to have a couple of interviews, one coming up at... 3:30, we're going to have Mozam Beg on, who wrote the book Enemy Combatant. And let me warn you about something. It is a wonderful book. It is a great book, well written. It's one of those ones you don't want to put it down once you start reading it. But it's very difficult to read in one way. You will find tears in your eyes and being ashamed sometimes, I'm pretty sure. I know I was. Anyway, he's going to be with us around about 3:30, and we're also going to have Tim Goodrich with us in the second hour, who is the co-founder of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Happy to have those gentlemen along with us today. And before I do anything else today, I want to take a moment and honor a very, very great lady. Ann Richard passed away yesterday. A great, great Democrat, one of the most clever, I loved Ann Richard, and I think we all did. You only had to hear her speak once or twice, and you fell in love with Ann Richard. So I just want to play a very quick tribute to her, and this is in memory of Ann Richards.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Buenas noches, mis amigos. I'm delighted to be here with you this evening because after listening to George Bush all these years, I figured you needed to know what a real Texas accent sounds like. Barbara Jordan, another Texas woman, Barbara made the keynote address to this convention, and two women in 160 years is about par for the course. a chance. We can perform. After all, Ginger Rogers did everything that Fred Astaire did. She just did it backwards and in high heels.
My oh my, the great Ann Richards, and my goodness, very, very many fond memories. Let me tell you something. If you get a chance to look at it, I wish I had saved the website. If you get a chance to see a speech that she gave to, it's among Google 100, the 100 great speeches. It's on there somewhere. If you get a chance to read the speech she gave in front of a small university, God, I can't think the name, which university it is. My word. What a speech. It's one of the greatest speeches I ever heard. And that piece you just heard was from the 1988 Democratic Convention in Atlanta, where she was the keynote speaker. And a marvelous woman, passed away at 73 years of age yesterday. I always said, always told people that if I could pick a couple of people to have dinner with, aside from my wife now, okay, I would like to have had dinner with Ann Richards and Molly Ivins. My God, would that have been fun for me? Or anyway, rest in peace, Ann Richards. 866-546-5254. You can give us a call if you like. 866-546-5254. Before I get very far on the program today, I've just got to settle something. I have to settle something. We all talked about the 9/11 commemoration on Monday, and we talked a little bit on Tuesday about some of the typical news shows on Sunday morning, and we mentioned a little bit about Meet the Press with Timmy Russert and Dick Cheney. And I had heard it, but until I watched the video of it last night, I hadn't yet grasped the full magnitude of what I'd heard. What I'm talking about, you ask, is that interview between Timmy Russert with Dangerous Dick Cheney on Meet the Press Sunday. And as I said, I had heard him say he wouldn't change a thing when Timmy had asked him if he could do it all over again, referring to the past 6 years, would he change anything? And Cheney said, no, I wouldn't change a thing. It was the look on his face when he said it that's what put me over the edge. This wasn't propaganda. This wasn't BS he's giving you. He meant it. He really meant it. That steely, cold, psychopathic look on his face was absolutely scary. He really did mean it. It's like that old joke. Guy was going to remarry his ex-wife. And they said that's kind of like going out to the refrigerator, getting out a carton of milk, taking a sip out of the milk, find out the milk's sour, and you put it back in, think it'll be better tomorrow. Kind of the same thing here. But Cheney said he wouldn't change a thing. He'd do the secret energy meetings with Screw the American Public all over again. He'd ignore all the warnings that they had about Osama bin Laden all over again. They'd ignore that that PDB that told them almost everything but which flight numbers the hijackers were going to be on in 9/11. Of course, he'd invade Iraq again on a pack of lies. He'd send our kids into battle without the necessary body armor. And the armor, of course, for their paperweight Humvees. And he's fine with the decision to disband the Iraqi army, which has led to this chaos and the looting that took place early on, especially the looting of the ammo dumps where the insurgents stole the munitions that they're still using to kill and rip the arms and legs off of our military personnel. He wouldn't change the decision to pull troops off the trail in Afghanistan, off the trail of bin Laden. He wouldn't change the fact that he was out in public every day, warning the people of the weapons of mass destruction. And he wouldn't change a damn thing about the Valerie plane leak. We know that. He wouldn't change a thing. I don't know about you, but I think those are the words and thoughts of a dangerous, raving lunatic. The man who assumes the throne, should Bush drop dead for some reason, you know, chokes on a pretzel or has a bike accident, that kind of thing. Now, I know that Cheney, and you know, has most likely been running the show for the past 6 years, and that's why he figured he could get away with saying what he said to Timmy. Because who's going to chew his ass out for saying it? Can you imagine Junior Bush calling Dickie Boy into the Oval Office and giving him holy hell about this? I don't think so. Dangerous Dick would tell him to go shut his mouth. And I'll tell you something. It's no secret to anybody that's listened to this program over the years, no secret that I despise this administration and everything they stand for and what they've done to the American people and the world, really. But when I saw the video of the Vice President of the United States saying that to Russert, I just lost it. My wife came running into the TV room and asked me what had happened because I'd let loose with a stream of expletives. I could repeat here. But I was so enraged, I've probably forgotten some of them. The very idea that Cheney would say such a thing shows me the utter contempt these people have for the American public. They don't give a rat's ass what we think about anything. They never did, and they never will. And my opinion of Junior Bush went down even farther. I didn't know it could, but it did. Any decent man, any man who claims Christian virtues, any man with even the tiniest shred of morality, any sense of right and wrong, would have called Cheney before he'd left the Meet the Press studio and told him to immediately report to the Oval Office, and then he would have told Cheney to resign and clean out his desk. Nobody who genuinely cares about this country would put up with Cheney making that statement. I don't know which one of them is more evil, the one who made the statement or the one who condoned it. It just further points out that neither of them has normal human feelings, and I hope to God that none of the parents of the kids who lost their lives because of the malfeasance of this administration were watching that program. The Vice President of the United States is a sociopath of the highest order. He's obviously a very sick, demented man who fits the very definition of insanity. To think that this man, I do it all over again. My God. It left me speechless. I heard it Sunday, and I was totally pissed. But last night, up comes that video. I was searching around, and up comes that video, and I sat there and I watched it, and the look on his face, he's the most evil, vile, contemptible man. And if you listen to Mark's program earlier today, I got to hear a little bit of it at the end. He's right. He's absolutely right. It wouldn't be hard to write a thesis about the evils and the lies of Dick Cheney. He's a monster. It's absolutely what he is. Well, I guess I said enough about Dick Cheney. I guess you know how I feel about him, but And then Tuesday, you know, these people are amazing. Tuesday, at the daily press conference, any of you, the rest of you stupid enough to sit around like I do on C-SPAN or wherever it happens to be and watch the daily press briefing, are any of you crazy enough to do that like I am? You know, Tuesday they had the daily press conference with the brilliant Tony Snow once again. Told America that although Bush himself had denied it, and the intelligence community has confirmed it, 9/11 indeed was connected to Saddam Hussein. When asked about the 9/11 Commission report on the subject of the collusion between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, Snow said this. I don't know if you caught this or not. I'm sure some of you did. But Snow said this. Quote, there was no direct operational. You know how they, you see how they start doing this? They start the parsing. There was no direct operational relationship. But there was a relationship. They were in the country. And I think you understand that the Iraqis knew they were there. That's the relationship. Isn't that typical of what they've been doing all along? Isn't that why so many people believe this crap from them? So, I was thinking about that. Let's use Tony's statement and carry his logic just a little bit further on the subject of 9/11. Let's use his logic. There was no direct operational relationship, but there was a relationship between the Bush administration and Al-Qaeda. They were in the country. And I think you understand that the Bush administration knew they were here. That's the relationship. Doesn't my statement make every bit as much sense as Tony Snow's? Of course it does. He took some information and he twisted it to say what he wanted to say, and so did I. My statement was every bit as true as his. So does that mean the Bush administration was complicit in the 9/11 attacks? Is that some kind of proof? Remember, we're using Tony Snow's own logic here. And remember, this is the spokesman for the White House talking. This is the guy whom we're told is smart, politically astute, and qualified to speak for the administration. Now, after hearing Tony's statement, I want to pose the obvious question. Was he speaking for the Bush administration when he said that, or was he just reverting back to his former position as a mouthpiece for the administration working for Fox News? Because at Fox, you know, they're not accountable to anyone. They can say any damn thing they want, and they don't have to answer to anybody. But as the White House press secretary, Snow is obliged to tell the American public the truth. He's on our payroll. At least that's what I've always expected from the press secretary. So now we have the president in a speech a couple of days ago saying that Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11. The 9/11 commission says that, and he agrees with it. So the American public hears the president say it, but still, behind the scenes, the Bush administration still is spreading that lie on a daily basis. Snow, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, all of them spread it every chance they get. But when confronted with the truth, they say, oh, no, the president admitted it isn't true. It's called having your cake and eat it in two, and that's exactly what they've been doing. You wonder why 50% of the American public believes Saddam was directly involved in 9/11? There's your answer. A very well-coordinated disinformation campaign carried out absolutely masterfully. One would have to go back 70 years in history to find a political group so adept at spreading lies. I know. So you say, here we go again with the Hitler-Nazi references. Tell me something. I was thinking about this last night. You take Hitler and the Nazis out of the equation. And what do we use for a reference point for this kind of thing? How far back in history do you have to go to find propagandists on an equal footing with the Junior Bush administration? Why the Third Reich references all the time? Because that is the point in history that exactly mirrors what this administration is trying to accomplish. Control the masses with disinformation and lies. Make them think you're well-meaning, honest, and patriotic, and religious, and all the while you're cleaning out Fort Knox, dispersing it to your friends, you're making the weapons, the arms dealer for almost the entire world. And at the same time, you're solidifying your power by changing the Constitution of the United States to mean what you want it to mean. gaining 100% control over the private lives of the people who've entrusted you with the keys to the kingdom because you've convinced them that you're worthy of their trust. That is why you hear the references to the Führer. Because that era is the only time in history that compares to what is happening to our nation right now. Tony Snow should be ashamed. But he is not. Cheney, Bush, and Rumsfeld should be ashamed. But by now it's obvious that they don't know the meaning of the word. If the Democrats take control of the Congress in a couple of months, and I believe they will, if they succeed in gaining power, if they do not at least attempt to impeach Bush for his obvious crimes against America, then they will not have done their most important duty as our elected representatives, and that's to protect the citizens of this nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And it has to be said that the Bush administration is the greatest danger this nation has ever faced. I forget who said it. I think it's been said by several people that when fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in the flag. It has arrived. And it is clothed in the flag. And it's carrying the Bible as well. Somehow the voters of this country have to understand that the greatest danger to this nation is not Al-Qaeda. Not at all. It is domestic terror that we have to worry about. Absolutely. You can give us a call, 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. Love to have you join us on the program today. My goodness, you know, I was taking a look around the news a little bit before we went on the air today. And I see they caught the number two guy again over there. And the number four. How come they never get number three? I've heard four a couple of times. I've heard two, what, two dozen, three dozen times they've caught the number two guy. Oh, my. And I also saw that they're recalling all of those Segways. Said it could make people fall down. They got something wrong with the computer chip in them. It could make people fall down. Is that what happened to Junior Bush when he was riding that one that day? I kind of doubt it. Oh, my. Yes, indeed. Hey, what else was it we were going to talk about here today? I guess nothing. I'll see you. No. give us a call, 866-546-5254, 866-546-5254. Love to hear from you. And what are we going to do? I think we're going to go to a break right now and get a hold of our guest.
All the other girls here are stars, you are the northern lights. They try to shine in through your curtain, you're too close and too bright. They try and they try, but everything that they do is the ghost of a trace of a pale imitation of you. I'll be the one to drive you back home, Kathleen. This party was made with the night air and the chance that a smile will wipe its way from your face to one of the boys in your line. Well, you act like you're hip to their tricks and you're strong, but a virgin, wordlets are hard, never once had a song. I'll be the one to drive you back home. Going your way anyway. If you'd like to come along, I'll be yours for a song. Ooh, ooh, ooh.
Okay, we are back, and glad to have all of you with us this afternoon here on the Guy James Show. As promised, I now have as our guest the author of what I want to tell you is one fantastic book, and it's written by a gentleman by the name of Mozam Begg. We are calling him, you're in London, Mozam?
I'm in Birmingham, England.
Oh, Birmingham. Okay, that's your hometown, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
Born and raised in Birmingham, England. I finished reading your book very early this morning. And as I mentioned to you earlier when I had a chance to chat with you just for a moment, that it's a book that's hard to put down once you start reading. But as an American, it is also a very difficult book to read in as much that it makes me very ashamed. We're getting a lot of feedback here on the phone.
I think that when somebody tells me that they're ashamed of it, I feel sad for them, because I know that all Americans are not responsible for what took place. Indeed, even a lot of the soldiers were decent people. So I think it's just so important for that sentiment to come across.
It's just a horror story. It's just absolutely a horror story that it's something we're going through here in America right now with our personal privacy, our rights, and so forth that we're trying to protect from this government. And to find that we treated somebody that's not even a citizen of this country in this manner is, it disgusts me. And you were literally, for those of you that don't know the story, Mozam, you were literally pulled out of your bed in the middle of the night, were you not?
Yes, it was midnight precisely when there was a knock on my door in my house in Islamabad where I was living with my wife and my children. And when I went to answer the door, there were guns put to my head, I was thrown to the ground, I was shackled, hood put over my head. I was physically carried into the back of this vehicle. Never to see my family again. I was told many years later that my daughter actually woke up and saw them doing the dastardly deed, and this left a terrible scar in her mind.
And that's the last time your family heard from you for a long time.
Yes. For all intents and purposes, I've been kidnapped. It wasn't even an arrest by any standards of the term arrest. They didn't even search me. They didn't read me my rights. They didn't even ask me my name. Not until I arrived at this so-called unknown location with a hood over my head.
And this was in Islamabad, Pakistan.
That's right, yes. This was in Islamabad, Pakistan.
And you had just moved there, right, from Birmingham?
Well, what had happened is that I had been living in Afghanistan with my wife and my children, where we had begun a project to build a school for young girls and a project that we'd already been working on to build wells. But when the bombing began, we evacuated to Pakistan, where I have family, and I also have relatives and my father and mother come from originally.
And so what reason did they give you? I've read the story, and I hope everybody will, but when they first took you to this place where they took you in the middle of the night after they had put a hood over your head, right? What did they tell you? What kind of a reason did they give you for this?
Well, you know, the first question that I was ever asked was actually inside this vehicle where I was lying in the prone position, shackled with my hands behind my back and a hood over it in my head. Somebody lifted a hood, and it was clearly an American from his accent, and although he was dressed in local Pakistani attire. And he said, he produced a pair of handcuffs, and he said that I'd come to capture, that I was given these handcuffs by one of the wives of the victims of September 11th in order to capture the perpetrators. And I remember feeling that, you know, this was ridiculous, but I was terribly frightened because I couldn't believe that this is what was happening. I thought it was perhaps not a joke, because it was too frightening to be a joke, but a gross, an inability to realize how far they've gone. And subsequently, when I was questioned about all sorts of things, about my past, where I'd been, and all those sorts of things, it seemed to me that it was a fishing trip, an intelligence gathering exercise with nothing specific in mind. And that was true over the next 3 years of interrogation.
Well, one of the most horrible things had to be in your mind, and you speak about it often in the book, you didn't know about the welfare of your wife and children. You didn't know if they had been abducted as well.
No, I mean, that was the biggest. I mean, even thinking about that now, it just makes things shivers down my spine. It's hard to talk about it, but one of the things that happened is that I had a mobile phone in my pocket, which they didn't search, because if they'd been police, they would have searched me. And so when I was in this cell, the first person I phoned was a friend who lived close by, and asked him to go and check on my wife and kids. And then I phoned my father in England and told him that I'd been kidnapped. I didn't know what was happening, but I knew Americans were present, and could he make sure that my family were okay and inform somebody of my case. For the next 7 months, I had no idea what had happened to my wife or children.
It was 7 months before you had any idea. My God, that's terrible. That is really terrible. It's also rather startling to me that they hooded you, took you away, used those nylon cuffs on you or whatever, and didn't search you to take away your cell phone. Thank God you had that cell phone on you.
You know, that's one of the strange things about that whole incident. That I couldn't believe that I put my hand in my pocket. So I was about to go to sleep myself. So normally the cell phone wouldn't have been in my pocket, but, you know, just by chance it was there. And, you know, that was how things transpired. At least the first part of my story got out to my father, who had some idea of who was present when I was taken.
Can you tell our listeners, I found this interesting, when they first cuffed you, an American put some cuffs on you, and he said something that I found rather interesting and startling. Can you tell us about the special handcuffs he had?
Yeah, he said that I was given these handcuffs by one of the wives of the victims of September the 11th for me to catch the perpetrators. And I remember, you know, it was ludicrous, because I saw this man dressed as a Pakistani, and he looked ridiculous, because it was obvious that he wasn't. So I thought about, I felt like laughing, and at the same time I'm terrified in how I feel. And then I said, wouldn't you think you're really stupid for having caught the wrong person? But it just didn't make any difference to him, because I was in custody at that point.
And the Pakistanis that were with them, that were involved in this kidnapping, is really what it was, they treated you much differently, did they not, than the Americans did?
Well, yeah, the Pakistanis were extremely apologetic right from the beginning. The older guy called me son or nephew and things like that. They didn't put me in a cell, they put me in a room, and they felt very bad about coming into my house. They saw there was obviously no terrorist type of related material in my house, or that I was involved in anything like that. I was a family man. And so one of them said, look, I know that what I'm about to do, before handing me over to the Americans, is that I'm selling my temporal life and my life of the hereafter, in essence, selling myself to the devil for what I'm about to do. They were very apologetic.
And I found it very interesting as to why they were apologetic, why they told you they had to do what they did. Could you tell us that, please?
Well, yes. I mean, their whole position was, you know, when President Bush had said to the world that you're either with us or against us, there's no sort of, you know, you can't be equipped in this. You're either with us or against us. And that's how they said they reacted. This is at the behest of the Americans. If we don't do this, we will get such a hard strike that we will never be able to recover. So they felt, at least their justification for them was because they were compelled to behave in this way.
I don't think there's any question that Musharraf thought he was going to be next. I'm sure of it.
Yes, I think probably that's probably partly true, yes.
So how was it, how long was it before you ended up in Kandahar then?
Well, then it was a couple of weeks, and after that I was handed over to U.S. custody, and, you know, strangely enough, I thought Pakistan, being a third world country, I expect to get beaten here a little bit, but the Pakistanis were fine. It's only when I was in American custody that all that sort of treatment began, and I couldn't believe I was in the hands of Americans. I couldn't believe that this is what Americans, how Americans behave. It boggled my mind completely. I mean, I'd seen it in Hollywood movies, but in reality, I wouldn't have ever thought. And of course, the other thing is that as far as I was concerned, when the Americans saw me, dark skin, got a short beard, you know, as far as they're concerned, he's just another one of them talibs, hajis, or whatever terms that they use to derogate people with. And I overheard everything that they were saying and understood clearly what they were saying when they swore at us, when they mocked our faith, our size, our physique, anything. But that was just one part of it. We were being stripped naked with knives tearing off our clothes. You could feel the knife, cold steel against your skin, ripping it off. Dogs barking, people spitting and shouting and screaming at you, taking photographs, shackling us naked, and then taking us for interrogation naked when we're shivering in the cold and being asked ludicrous questions like, when was the last time you saw Osama bin Laden? When was the last time you saw Mullah Omar? And this was a standard question for every detainee who passed through this interrogation process.
Do you think they were serious with these questions, or were they just trying to break you?
Well, I think the treatment was certainly, you know, what they call processing. That was, you know, I quote the guards' words themselves, is to terrify you. I mean, it is a tactic of terror in the sense that you want to terrify the man in order that he becomes pliable and that he will answer questions without any further need for strong or harsh interrogation techniques. But I think a lot of the questioning that they came out with was clearly they didn't have a clue. They didn't know whether the person they had in custody was an Afghan or an Arab or a Turk or whatever. As far as they were concerned, these guys have just been handed over to us by our people, the intelligence services, and they know best. We are just the guards, and we'll take it from here.
Now, you speak several languages, correct?
Yes, I speak English, Urdu, and Arabic.
Okay. And you were lucky in as much as you could speak to many of the other prisoners there when you got a chance to, finally. But for a long time, you were forbidden to speak to other prisoners. Is that correct?
Yeah. Again, it changed. The rules changed from place to place. But in Bagram, where I was moved to almost 6 weeks later, the rules included that talking to another detainee, even though he was next to you, was a failure to comply to the rules, which would end up in you being punished, either having sit on your knees with your hands behind your head for several hours, or having your hands tied above the cage to the top with a shackle, and then having a hood placed on it and being left like that for several hours.
Was it when you were in Bagram that they had threatened to possibly send you to Egypt?
Yes, that was probably the most frightening time in relation to what my future held, and for me, that prospect of being sent to Egypt was extremely frightening, particularly because they said that they sent a former senior al-Qaeda member there a couple of weeks before me to Egypt, where they tortured him. And I learned subsequently since my release that this man's statement was used as a justification to enter Iraq because he was supposed to have said that he was working on obtaining weapons of mass destruction from Saddam Hussein, which of course turned out to be a lie and turned out to be something he said under... torture.
Is it then true that the average man, not being any hero or a super tough guy or something, is it true the average man finally will say anything they want him to say to avoid the torture?
Well, you know, I suppose there is arguments that people will tell the truth, but I'm sure that, you know, to make it just stop and go away and to the fear go, you'll tell them whatever you want. I mean, there's one time I told them, just for a joke, that I shot Kennedy. You know, whatever you want me to say, I'll say it. Just stop this. I heard the sounds of a woman screaming next door, and I told you that I still didn't know what was happening to my wife.
Yeah, you might have thought that might have been your wife.
Yeah, I was too afraid to ask the question. I don't know if you know sometimes when you're too afraid to ask the question because you're too afraid for the answer. I was afraid to ask this question. But they certainly played off the idea because I kept on asking about my wife and children and their welfare and writing letters to them, which of course were going through their censorship before they went to the Red Cross. And so they had these photographs from my house of my family and waved them in front of me during interrogation, saying, do you think they're safe? Where do you think they are now? What do you think happened to them? And sort of rather than not saying that we've got your family here, but just alluding to the point that I didn't know where they were.
And I remember reading that you were constantly hearing that this was all about saving innocent American lives.
Yeah, you know, as if, you know, any other lives around the world are not innocent or, you know, worth saving or can be destroyed, but I didn't understand how that was going to save lives. I mean, all that was doing was destroying lives. It wasn't saving lives.
Yes, yes, indeed. The MI5 people, I get from your book that they even treated you far better than the Americans did.
Well, you know, the MI5, I think, they felt rather uncomfortable with the whole thing. I remember when I was taken into the first interrogation and MI5 turned up, and of course, MI5 did use this as a way of being there as observers to get information, although they felt, I think, according to what I understand, quite disturbed. One of the MI5 guys, when he saw me with a hood being brought in by two soldiers pushing me down in a bowing position, he said, "Is that all necessary?" And they said, "Yes, it is." And then he just shut his mouth and carried on. But yes, I think they always said, their position was that this is Mr. Bush's show, it's got nothing to do with us. Your best opportunity, your best bet is to cooperate with the Americans.
So, yeah, they really had no say on how it was going to go. So then they flew you to Kandahar, and you became prisoner number 558.
That's correct, yes, prisoner number 558.
And
who I was for all of that time, yes.
How long were you in Kandahar?
Kandahar, the audio lasted for about 6 weeks, and then the rest, as I told you, was in Bagram, where I spent almost 11 months.
Why did they make and the conditions? The conditions in Kandahar. How was that compared to Bagram?
Well, you know, Kandahar was this place where I was held in what they call in a disused barn, and they divided each barn off with razor wire into different cells. So I was in there for a while, and then I was put in a communal cell, which was just a wooden hut that had been built, and in which there were 20 or so other detainees. The most disgusting thing about all of this was that we, about 20 detainees, had to share a metal bucket as a toilet, and that's what everybody had to use there. And it was one of the most disgusting, humiliating type of situations that I've...
The humiliation and the degradation is part of it all, isn't it?
Certainly, yes, because, I mean, it's part of the dehumanization process in which somebody looks at you and sees that you're different, and therefore... it's easy for them to look at you in a subhuman way and to treat you as such.
Did you, when you were in Kandahar, did you talk to the CIA at that point?
No, I don't believe so. Not in Kandahar. In Bagram, I did talk to them, yes.
Yes, okay. And I found it unusual that you saw several of the same people on this journey between... Gitmo and Kandahar? I can't remember, between Bagram.
Yes, yes. No, you're right. Several of them turned up and returned again and showed their faces. And yes, I think it was rather odd because I think, you know, there were hundreds of interrogations and so many faces that I came across. But there were some particular ones who repeatedly came over intermittent periods of time. And I think they felt that... you know, they'd established some sort of rapport with me or somehow that, you know, certainly some members of the FBI were telling me that if I cooperate with them, then I'll get to go to court I'll have my day in court, and I will be able to get a plea bargain and all that, all those sorts of things. And one thing, blatantly, I didn't understand. What is it that I have done? And that was, to them, it was irrelevant. It was insignificant. It doesn't matter what you've done. Just agree to plea bargain, agree to plead guilty. Charges don't matter. That's irrelevant.
That's all they wanted was a guilty plea.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about it now, it's so bizarre. But at that time, they said, look, your only way out is to plead guilty.
Hmm.
And I said, to what? I said, well, whatever we say, it doesn't matter. Because you're, otherwise, as far as we're concerned, you're already convicted. The fact that you're here, you're already convicted.
Let me ask you, since that happened, and I want to get back to, how long were you in Kandahar?
Kandahar was 6 weeks, Bagram 11 months.
And why was the decision made then to send you to Guantanamo? Do you have any idea why they decided to send you there?
I think that as far as their sort of procedure was concerned, there were no non-Afghans who weren't sent to Guantanamo. Every non-Afghan was sent to Guantanamo. Even a great deal of Afghans themselves were sent to Guantanamo. But I think every foreign national who was held in Bagram went directly to Guantanamo Bay. I didn't hear of any of them going anywhere else. So I think that that was part of the procedure. But as far as I was concerned individually, I was actually asking to go to Guantanamo by the time... if you can imagine, for me, Bagram was much worse than Guantanamo was.
Much worse.
Hadn't seen the sun in 11 months, or the moon, or anything else. I witnessed the deaths of two detainees getting beaten. We weren't allowed to walk or to talk without express permission. We weren't allowed to move around. Lights were on 24 hours a day, glaring in our faces. There was a bucket we had to share, a barrel, as a toilet between 20 of us, and it was filthy and disgusting.
And you could hear people being beaten at night?
Well, I could hear the screams of people. I thought it was interrogators, I saw people getting beaten, let alone hearing their sounds. And it wasn't nice. In the last days, they built these other cells where they started playing really loud music, sort of Marilyn Manson and Eminem and all those sorts of things. As far as I'm concerned, it wasn't a big deal. But for a lot of Afghan villagers who are being subjected to that sort of treatment, it was very, very bewildering.
Now, you'd heard it before in Birmingham.
Yes,
of course. So this was actually a much different experience for you than it was for the native Afghanis and the Pakistani people, the natives there. This was...
Yes, absolutely, because, I mean, I've never been west of Ireland. I've never been to America. America came to me, as it were. But I've always known American culture through TV, through, British culture is so similar in many ways to American culture. And I grew up watching the Dukes of Hazzard and things like that, so I could even relate to the Southern Guard. But if you imagine the Afghan or the Saudi or the Pakistani, he has, as far as he's concerned, you know, America is just sort of this distant, far-off country which is a beacon of human rights and beacon of democracy and all that's good. But what they saw was something that would have changed their perspective forever.
I wish you knew how disturbing this all is to me. I wish you knew. I really do. So after the confession, the six-page confession. First let's go to you. While in Kandahar, they decided to fly you to Guantanamo, That's a long flight.
It was, from what I understand, 36 hours. Now, because I had already heard from some guards that it was going to be a very painful journey and a long one, and when they shackled us to the seat, our hands, legs, stomachs, our hands are shackled to our waist, and then goggles placed over our eyes, and then earmuffs, and then face masks, and then a hood on top for good measure, it's extremely uncomfortable. And I pleaded with them to give me some sort of a sedative to knock me out so that I wouldn't have to endure this sort of pain, which they did oblige, and I was given a tablet to knock me out, sedative. And so I woke up in a daze in Guantanamo.
I'm surprised they did that. I really am surprised they acceded to your request. Did others they do it for others as well?
I don't know. I don't think they did. As I said, I think I've probably had a better time than most, and that was because I spoke English and I'm generally a compliant sort of person. I don't like trouble.
And did a lot of the prisoners give him a lot of trouble?
No, they didn't. But the problem was that communication. You see, when the guards can't communicate with somebody, they start shouting and screaming at them as if the shouting or raising the decibels a few pitches higher will make them understand any better. But, of course, it didn't. And when translators weren't around, which it was most of the time, and they started getting angry, and the detainee in return got upset too because he doesn't know why he's being shouted at. And sometimes I could translate for some of them, but some of the languages I don't speak, so it was a problem.
Well, it's obvious to me, and it'll be obvious to anybody that goes through the book, that they will find that your faith, your religion sustained you throughout this. Did you find any resentment toward you from the Americans in these prisons over that?
Again, I don't think to me personally, but, you know, sometimes what's probably worse than your own humiliation is watching somebody else's and being impotent and not doing anything about it. I saw one guard, you know, walking into Bagram, and what they used to do is cell searches, and we'd have to go to the end of the cell when they came to search it. But there was one guy who was still praying, and the guard came in, and he dragged him from his hair, threw the Quran down on the floor, and then said to him, "You dog, I'm your God here. I'm the only one you should be worshipping here." And it was so demeaning because you do that to a man who's praying, and, you know, when somebody's in prayer, whatever religion or faith he happens to be, it's the most serene and most tranquil time that he's having, that he's communicating with his Creator, and people should respect that, but he evidently didn't.
That is one thing that you shared with almost everybody that was captured in prison with you. You almost all were of the Muslim faith, right?
That's correct, yes. Absolutely all of them, yes.
And in the different languages and so forth, well, you know, the language transcends that, doesn't it? I mean, if you didn't speak Afghani language and so forth, as far as the Quran is concerned and all, everybody knew what everybody was doing. And did you pray together?
No, we weren't allowed to pray together. That was another restriction that we had. We weren't allowed to pray together. So everybody had to pray individually because they felt that the congregational thing would actually bring people together, and that might create some form of resistance, so we weren't allowed to do that. So everybody was, you know, just prayed individually.
So we get to Guantanamo, and life improves for you a bit there. How long were you in Guantanamo altogether?
A total of 2 years. When I first arrived in Guantanamo, I was taken for the first 20 months and held in what they call Camp Echo, which is an isolation block. And if you can imagine, like, sort of a small room that measures about 8 foot by 15, and inside this small room is an even smaller cell that measures 8 foot by 6 foot. I was in that cell for the next 20 months.
20 months by yourself?
Yeah, well, other than the guards who came in and did their observations. Yeah.
When did you start to understand that it was going to be possible for you to get out of there?
I think it took a long, long time. Again, for me, the lifeline, as it were guards who didn't agree with what was taking place, or even if they did agree with what was taking place, didn't like the way in which it was happening. And some of those guards told me snippets of information which, for me, were a lifeline. For example, that in 2004 in the United States, there was a Supreme Court decision in which it was ruled that the detainees had the right for habeas corpus, in other words, that they either get charged with a crime or that they're released. Of course, nothing's ever transpired as a result of that, but that decision, when it was passed, my hopes went up. And strangely enough, the one who told me this was a guy from Alabama. He was about 60 years old, who'd been brought back from retirement. He'd served 2 tours of duty in Vietnam as a volunteer, and he was certainly no tree hugger by any stretch of the imagination. And yet he felt so terrible at about how we were being treated. So it was people like him who helped to sustain my ability and faith in the idea that I might get freed at some point.
Well, I'm proud of him for acting like a decent human being.
And there were, in my experience, to be fair to the guards, there were plenty of decent ones. The only problem was that I got to know that because I was individually with them in an isolated cell. On the blocks, I think, from what I've understand, because of peer pressure on both sides, it's not usually the case.
Ah, yes, the peer pressure would be completely different, and a guard probably wouldn't last there very long if he showed any compassion toward the prisoners.
No, I think a few of them from places like the Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands who'd never been activated as soldiers before, found that all very daunting, and several of them, I believe, got reprimanded for what they call, quote-unquote, fraternizing with the enemy.
Yes, yes. Well, finally you got to meet with somebody that said that they're going to take you back to Great Britain.
Yes, a major came along and told me that I was going home, and I certainly didn't believe it. I thought he was lying to me. I thought it was another ploy. So I asked the guards, who I trusted a little more than I trusted him, and they confirmed it for me that the other British detainees along with me were also going to be sent back home, and that the ordeal was finally going to be over. So it was a mixture of emotions. One was the sheer joy of freedom. Another one was apprehension as to what's going to happen when I get back home. Will my family recognize me? What about my children? I had a child born 6 months after I was taken into custody. Will he want to know me? Will he hate me? Will people in Britain hate me? Will they like me? All sorts of apprehensions, which I had no idea. But still, overriding above all of that was the fact that I was going home. So there could be nothing better than that.
Well, you got back to Britain, and how were you received?
Amazingly. I mean, obviously my father had been campaigning very, very... very diligently and had mounted this high-profile campaign for my release. But the reception since I have returned has been amazing, truly amazing from people, and particularly, I would say, from the Muslim community. I mean, the Muslim community have this obvious sympathy, but from what was surprising to me was the non-Muslim community here that welcomed me in a way, and still does, that I couldn't have imagined. So for me, it was very good. I think it was important that I spoke to the media to allay people's fears that I wasn't this ranting, raving terrorist bent on destroying and killing innocent Americans. And once I think that people realize that, then they start thinking about and talking about the reality of places like Guantanamo and the others left behind. Because if there's anything that really gives me a sense of guilt, it's the fact that other people are held there in similar circumstances to what I was, and are not going to be released because they're from backgrounds whose countries haven't campaigned for their release, and sometimes I've seen met some of their children, and the hardest question that they ask me is that, when is my dad coming home? I don't know what to do then.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, I'm so thankful that you're out and you're a free man and enjoying life again. Your family was happy to see you, and that's all come back together again for you, okay?
Yes. There was a new addition to the family who I'd never seen, so taking just time to bond with him. But with the other family members, it was fantastic because my wife had kept my memory alive through photographs and the intermittent letters that I wrote. So it's a great joy to be with my children. Some of the things that I'd planned in Guantanamo, like taking them to visit different parts of the country, I've realized those plans, I've realized those dreams. So I'm happy in that sense that they weren't just dreams.
Well, Mozam, I admire your resolve, I admire your courage, I admire that you're speaking out, and this book... I hope it is a huge seller for you. It's just a wonderful book, and it's called The Enemy Combatant: My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar by Mozam Beg. And Mozam, I want to thank you so very much for being on the program today.
Well, it's my pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
And I once again I want to apologize.
Not at all. There are certain people who are responsible for and. Just in the same way that I shouldn't have to apologize for what Bin Laden did.
Well, that's true, but you know, we Americans, we're arrogant people, and we like to think that we don't treat people that way. And I know many people who are horrified by the treatment that people have gotten. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
That's a story that just. It's awful. Enemy Combatant. The book's available everywhere. It's on Amazon. It's in the bookstores. It's a terrific read. It makes you ashamed. I can tell you. I it's terrible. It's just terrible. And it's not like this guy's some renegade that wrote this book. This book And his treatment has been corroborated by many, many, many people. And he was held by Pakistani people. He was held, interrogated by British people. And nobody treated him worse than the Americans. And I'm so ashamed of that. I'm so very ashamed of that. Well, how can you make up taking away 3 years of a man's life away from his family? You can't. I hope things go very well for him. Well, you're listening to the Guy James Show, and on the Head On Radio Network, we're going to pause for news right now. We hope you'll stick around. Got another guest coming up all around quarter past the hour here, so stay tuned. You're going to like that.
This is the Quality News Network. Three prominent Republican senators have now been joined by former Secretary of State Colin Powell in objecting to the president's proposal to prosecute terrorism suspects in military tribunals and to redefine what acts under the Geneva Convention constitute war crimes. Senators McCain, Warner, and Graham, all of the military veterans, say the proposal, if enacted, could put U.S. troops in other countries at risk. President Bush was on Capitol Hill this morning to lobby congressional Republicans for his agenda. Former Texas Democratic Governor Ann Richards is being remembered today as a feisty and flamboyant yet consummate politician. Richards died last night of cancer at the age of 73. In Iraq today, two U.S. soldiers are among at least 18 people killed by car bombs and drive-by shootings in and around Baghdad. The number of U.S. military deaths is now at least 2,673. Lebanon's prime minister says his army will confiscate any weapons it finds in southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, Hezbollah is accusing Israel of flagrant violations of the month-old truce. Israel denies it. And both Hezbollah and Israel are being accused by Amnesty International of possible war crimes and urging the U.N. to conduct an investigation. Hamas cabinet ministers have handed in their resignations to Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh, the first step in forming a new coalition government. The Palestinians are hoping that a new administration will open the doors to international aid, which was shut off earlier this year when Hamas took over the government. Poland has agreed to send 1,000 troops to Afghanistan, becoming the only NATO country to respond to a plea from NATO's top commander for reinforcements, but none of the Polish troops will be deployed before February. In Afghanistan, NATO says that its biggest offensive against the Taliban has now entered its final stage. So far, Operation Medusa has left more than 500 insurgents dead. 20 foreign troops have also been killed. UN inspectors are calling for a U.S. congressional report about Iran's nuclear program. They're calling it both outrageous and dishonest. They say it erroneously describes Iran's nuclear activity as being far more advanced than it is. The Atlantis crew has fixed a problem with two newly installed solar panels, which clears the way for tomorrow's third and final spacewalk of a mission, which ends next Wednesday. Montana's 200,000-acre Derby fire now 80% contained, but the jungle fire in Montana has doubled in size in the past 24 hours, still burning out of control about 15 miles from Livingston. Residents of nearly 400 homes are being evacuated. And Hurricane Gordon has been upgraded to a Category 3 hurricane, but poses no threat to land. Business and science are next.
Most people would rather have a root canal than go to a dealer to buy a car. But you can turn dread into joy when you learn how to play the car buying game. Read the book, Right Car, Right Price, and you'll discover how the game is played and how you can win every time. Whether you're buying a car or a truck, new or used, Right Car, Right Price explains how to find and buy the vehicle best suited to your individual transportation needs. Auto Week called Right Car, Right Price the right stuff. So take the hassle out of car buying. Read Right Car, Right Price, and every time you get into your new car, you'll know you've got a great deal. Go online to rightcarrightprice.com to order your copy today. It only takes an hour to read Right Car, Right Price, and it just costs $10. We even pay the postage. So go to rightcarrightprice.com right now. It'll be one of the best decisions you ever make.
The distant orbiting body, previously known informally as Xena, has now been officially named Eris after the Greek goddess of chaos. It was the discovery of Eris that led to the redefinition of a planet and Pluto's demotion to a status like Eris of a dwarf planet. Scientists say they've discovered a large planet orbiting a distant star that's larger but much lighter than Jupiter, but doesn't have a solid core, a fact they say could lead to re-examining theories about how planets are formed. NASA studies show that the Arctic sea ice in winter is melting much faster than before, a sure sign of man-made global warming. Segway is recalling all of its 23,500 self-balancing scooters that it's already shipped out because of a software problem they say could make the wheels suddenly reverse direction, causing riders to fall off. The Commerce Department reports that August retail sales were up just 0.2%, their weakest performance since June. The head of Russia's central bank has been assassinated in Moscow. Prosecutors say it may have been a contract killing. And the International Monetary Fund says the U.S. economy is expected to cool next year, while the world economy heads for its strongest expansion in three decades. Gold is trading this hour at $592, down $4.03 an ounce. Oil, light sweet crude, trading down 21 cents at $63.71 a barrel. On Wall Street, the markets are mixed. The Dow down 18 points at 11,525. NASDAQ is flat at 2227. And the S&P 500 down 2 at 1315. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm
can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. I have to be honest with you. I always am. I had a hard time over the news hour getting myself composed after that. Is talking to him. I talked to him earlier in the day. And talking to him now, it's such an awful story that it just has affected me in a terrible way, a terrible way. I told everybody to listen carefully right after the top of the hour, and here's what I want to do. Here's what I want to do. I have a brand spanking new copy of that book, Enemy Combatant: My Imprisonment at Guantanamo by Mozambique. And I'm going to give it to the third caller. And I'm going to give it to the third caller. It's a $27 book. You will enjoy this book. The third caller that calls right now, 866-546-5254. 866-546-5254. The third caller, I'll ship this book to you. We'll get your address by email. The third caller right now. And boy, the phones aren't lighting up. Is anybody listening? First time I ever try and give away something on the show. I'll have to tell you a story about some turkeys one time in my first radio job. Anyway, okay, I guess nobody's interested in the book. Interesting. I shouldn't have started that business now, should I? Now I'm in limbo here. Don't know what to do. Maybe somebody will call and I'll have to answer it and interrupt what I'm doing and the whole business. Is this thing working? 866-546-5254? I have to wonder. I have to wonder. All right. Well, we'll do it another time. Time's gone on that. So we'll do it another time. Not going to do it today. We'll do it another time. You've noticed, I'm pretty sure, that we've got a new name for an old enemy, the Islamo-fascist. And odd, don't you think, that when we invaded Iraq, there was no mention of fascists being there? You remember fascists being there? You know, allegedly there were huge stockpiles of nuclear weapons and chemical weapons and everything else there. Now the phones are going nuts. All six lines lit up like a Christmas tree. Well, let's just do this. I'll just stop what I'm talking about right now, and I have to wait till they're all answered and go to the first one. Now, the first one I answer is not going to be the winner, okay? It's going to be the third one. All right. Hello, you are number one. Hello? Hello? Hello, you're number one.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. You're caller number one. Let's go to the second one here. Hello? You're caller number two. And here we are coming up on caller number three right here. You are caller number three.
Juanita?
Yes, Juanita.
You're kidding.
Yes, you have won the book.
Well, did I get the book?
Yes.
Oh, that's great. Well, I'm glad to get it, but I just wanted to say that first hour, everything, that should be played all over the world, you know, over and over again. All, what you said, you know, about the government and everything, and then that man, wasn't he a...
Well, it's an amazing story.
A very
story.
Dignified person, you know?
Amazing story. Amazing story. Do me a favor. Send me an email with your address, your mailing address.
Okay.
And I will ship this book to you.
Okay.
All right.
A lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Hi, you're on the Guy James Show. Well, why am I... Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hey, this is Sarge.
Hi, Sarge.
I was trying to call in, but the lines were busy, so I guess I lost out.
Yeah, they all got jammed there.
You know, you're talking about this guy, and his story is just really, really sad. And I'm embarrassed. I really am. This is not the way we're supposed to do business in this country, and... It's just not right. But like I was telling you in the chat, look at what they've done to Victor Lopez.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, the one thing that you'll find about Victor when you talk with him, this guy is just remarkable because he's mad. Yeah, he's very mad. But at the same time, he's in a place where rehabilitation is just not even mentioned. They said, well, if you want to be rehabilitated, do it yourself. Mm-hmm. And Victor has taken that challenge up, and he said, okay, I'll do it. And we gave him a column at powersandmorrison.com, and he's just turned out to be an excellent writer. And he has made his mind up. He's going into journalism. There is a U.S. assistant district attorney that is actually looking into his case, and there is a good hope that we're going to get him out. But you know, these kind of guys, man, you just gotta love them when they got the attitude that Victor has. And he said he wants to get out and he wants to work for change in America, and God, that's beautiful, you know.
Yes it is. Hey, I gotta move along today, Sarge. I got a couple more calls here, and then
okay.
I got another guest coming up shortly. And
okay, thank you, partner.
Hey, let me know about that phone number when you
when it's done.
Thank you. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, is this the real Guy James Show?
The real Guy James Show, yeah.
Congratulations to Juanita, a very loyal Guy James supporter. I congratulate her on the ability to receive that book by your guest today. And it was very a very touching experience for me to listen to that. This is Eric from Vermont. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was. It's hard to talk to him. It really is. I'm afraid I get all emotional when I talked to him this afternoon, and I couldn't talk for a while or earlier on today. I was speechless. And you know, he's so nice about it and all. But, wow. Quite a story.
Yeah, for the period of time that he was being abused by our government, yeah, I'm a Christian, and, you know, like there are a lot of other spiritual people of different religious persuasions that I don't know. That would pretty much...
Well,
make
you know,
me extremely cynical myself.
His faith is the only thing that sustained him. It was the only thing. You know, he's very devout about his prayers every day, and he told me that is absolutely what sustained him through that horrible experience, taking 3 years of his life away. And you know, I have to hand it to his family and everybody that he's got a very close family and a very big family, and they welcomed him home with open arms and have helped him adapt back into the society there in Birmingham. And boy, he can't come to the United States. Not allowed to come here.
That's a sad reflection upon our government as it stands today.
Guilty of nothing.
Hopefully, I beg your pardon?
Guilty of absolutely nothing, and he can't come to the United States.
He was guilty of being a good human being.
That's all. That's all.
Yeah. Anyway, congratulations to Juanita. I was thinking Juanita when you said the first third car. I was hoping that Juanita would be the person that got that. And keep up the good work.
Hey, thanks so much.
Have a great show for the rest of it. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. What should we do here?
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction.
No doubt. No doubt. No doubt whatsoever. No doubt that they've got weapons of mass destruction. I think what we're going to do is go to a break, and I'm going to get a hold of my next guest. That's what we should do. And we'll be back in just a minute or so. Don't go away.
That's right. This is one of my favorite songs from back home. Home on the range. Oh, give me a home where no liberals roam and the folks all think the same way. Where each house has a gun, a big caliber one, and strangers are told, make my day. Home, home on the range, where the beer and the cantaloupe lay, where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or so that it's one I can say. All right, got Condi on piano back there. Had to be careful with her, though. She's used to playing that Mozart, Beethoven crap. They let me play and make Congress go away. The agenda that I would put through, each grade through the eighth would be taught based on faith, where the children all praying on cue. Oh, home, home on the range, that's Texas, where the beer and the cantaloupe play, where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or so that it's one I can say. All right. Well, we're going to have Russ Limbaugh sing on this, but can't do it because of his cochlear implant. Sorry, Russ. Oh, the budget's a mess. Oh, that much, I'll confess. But I've got Saddam's gun on my wall, and I'll let the Psalms guide my nuclear bombs, them terrorists gone once and for all. That's right. Home, home on the range. Bring it on. Where the beer and the cantaloupe lay. Where seldom is heard a three-syllable word, or if so, then it's one I can say. That's right, bring it home. Here we go. Thank you, Bill O'Reilly on guitar. Thank you, Chaney on backup. Tom DeLay on the high tenor. That's right.
That's right. This is the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network. Don't forget, Don't you dare forget that coming up after our program today, we'll have Bruce Birch from 5 till 7, and after that, Bob Kincaid from 7 till 10, and after that, going to have a replay of a IE America Mike Malloy show from a few years back that I know you're going to want to hear. So everybody stay tuned for that, and as promised, we now have on the phone our second guest of the day, Tim Goodrich, and Tim is the founder of the Iraq Veterans for Progress. Tim, welcome to the Guy James Show.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
You're a busy guy. First of all, I did want to remind everybody in our audience today that Tim is no stranger to the Middle East deployment. You've been there two, three times?
I've been to the Middle East three times for the military and once into Iraq as a civilian.
All right. And tell us a little bit about your military deployment there, when and where and so forth.
Well, I deployed three times in the Middle East. The first was for Operation Southern Watch, which was helping to patrol the no-fly zones over Iraq. That was in 2001. 2 months after September 11th happened, I was sent over to provide combat support for Afghanistan. And then the third time, and perhaps the most important one, was 6 months before this current war started in Iraq, again helping to patrol the no-fly zones, but this time something was a little bit different. While President Bush was declaring that we would try diplomacy before we attacked Iraq, we were intensifying the bombing. And again, this was in the fall of 2002. When I saw this obvious lie, I started to investigate U.S. foreign policy and realized that the war would be wrong. Luckily, I got out of the military, honorable discharge, shortly after the war started, and then I traveled back to the Middle East and went into Iraq as a civilian in January of 2004 to see things from the other side.
You were on an AWACS plane?
I was an electronics technician on the E-3 AWACS, that's right.
Whoa. I just like to see the inside of one of those one time. I really would. They were intensifying the bombing 6 months before the war started?
That's right, and that's something the military and the Bush administration doesn't want the American public to know, because that would further incriminate them for their actions.
Well, what were your orders as the military at the time? Keep your mouth shut over this?
Well, you know, at the time, I wasn't able to see the entire scope because, you know, there's so many people in the military. You just have your small slice of pie in front of you. You just have your job, and that's what you're focused on. I could tell that our operational tempo had increased, but I couldn't tell by how much. And since the war has started, there have been a couple articles that have been written about this pre-war bombing to prepare for the invasion to come, and also some of my own investigation, and I've realized that the bombing increased at least 500% during this time.
Was it to take out anti-aircraft installations? What was it for?
Well, I think the original intention was to try to goad Saddam Hussein into retaliating so that we would have a reason to go to war, but him being a pretty smart guy, he didn't retaliate. So it had the secondary benefit for the U.S. of taking out the anti-aircraft installations, command and control centers, and basically paving the way for the ground forces to come in 6 months later.
Now, we've all heard, and specifically, I've heard Rumsfeld and Cheney say it myself, and I'm sure others have as well, that they violated the, all of a sudden I can't think of the name, the UN resolution by firing at our airplanes and so forth. But you say that he didn't retaliate while you were stepping up the bombing?
Well, the rules of engagement actually changed during this time as well. Before, when it had been the policy to only fire at the anti-aircraft sites if they were locked upon with the radar or they were proving to be an imminent threat to our planes that were patrolling the no-fly zone.
And you can tell that before they even fire, right? You can tell,
yes,
if they're locked,
right,
on you?
If they have a radar lock or something like that. So that was the policy before. It was a purely defensive policy, whereas during this time, the policy changed to be such that the United States and also Britain was guilty of this too. They could fire first, and also the targeting changed from not just anti-aircraft sites but also to command and control centers, the communications towers.
Okay. Well, where's this led you now? You've decided that that the American public has been bamboozled, as a lot of us have, and we seem like we get more indication and more proof of it every single day, almost, that there were obvious well, I wanted to say distortions, but I'll just say it lies about what actually happened there. What caused you to want to get involved in a program of doing something to enlighten the public and put a stop to this sort of thing?
Well, after returning from Iraq in January of 2004, I just realized how bad this occupation is going, and it didn't have to be like that, to tell you the truth. If we got in there with a plan, things today could be a much different story. But it's not like that, unfortunately, and thousands upon thousands of people, including our own troops and Iraqis, have died because of this. So I co-founded Iraq Veterans Against the War, in which I'm still active on my free time. Right now, however, the project that's taken priority because of the elections coming up is this political action committee that I started with the help of some other Iraq veterans called Iraq Veterans for Progress. And what we're doing is we're supporting candidates in the closest races around the country that support changing the course in Iraq and bringing our troops home. And so far we've endorsed our first two candidates, Jerry McNerney in Northern California. He's running against the incumbent Richard Pombo, who can, to give you an idea of how much he cares about the situation in Iraq, he doesn't even list Iraq on the issues page of either his campaign website or his Washington, D.C. website.
Doesn't even mention it.
Doesn't even mention Iraq on the website.
Oh, my God.
And then our other star candidate here right now is Bruce Braley. He's running for an open seat in Iowa's 1st Congressional District, and his opponent right now is saying the same things to the Bush administration, which we know are false, saying that if we don't fight them overseas, that they're going to come over here.
You know, I said yesterday, and I wonder if you can help me out. You're an ex-military guy. Can anybody, can you tell me, I challenged anybody yesterday to tell me anything that we've done in Iraq so far that would prevent an attack here?
Well, as we know, there was no terrorist connection with Iraq. And unfortunately, the longer we stay in Iraq, the more we're going to invite terrorism to spread it throughout the country and make the United States less safe, because now, in small numbers, people are coming across the borders and learning terrorist tactics and learning bomb-making skills and all these other things that could eventually be used against the U.S. Not only that, but we're inflaming the population of Iraq, and where before the Iraqi people had no problems with the United States, well, now we're creating those problems. That's why we see that the overwhelming amount of attacks against the United States are from the people that we originally went to liberate, the Iraqi people themselves. Now, obviously, the entire situation is not going well, and that's why I've created this Iraq Veterans for Progress. And as I said, we've already endorsed our first two candidates with more to come. Our main goal to help these candidates is to send unemployed Iraq veterans to work on our campaigns, not only doing media work, but doing face-to-face voter contact and just helping to get the word out about why Iraq veterans are behind these candidates. And to do this, we need support from the people. We need donations to get these unemployed Iraq veterans to work.
Excellent, excellent idea. Let's do it now, and then we'll do it again before we're done here. How would people donate to this?
Well, you can go on the website, and the website is www.IraqVetsForProgress.com or .org.
Okay, you got them both.
And just click on the donate button. We really need your support. We've got less than 60 days to make a difference in these elections and get some candidates in there that really support the troops and want to bring them home.
Well, volunteers are awfully I assume you're going to raise some money to try and pay some of these unemployed folks.
That's right. That'll actually be our campaign contribution. We're going to pay the salary for these unemployed Iraq veterans to go work.
Man, that's a great idea. That really is. That kind of warms my heart. That's a terrific idea. Is it a big problem coming home from the war and not having your job back or not being able to find your job right now?
It's unfortunate, but some estimates say that up to 50% of the people that are homeless on the streets are veterans. I've seen anywhere from 25 to 50% of the people on the streets are veterans of foreign wars. And this is just a situation that shouldn't be. And that's why we're supporting these candidates that support full funding of the VA and taking care of our troops when they return.
Well, this is a no-lose situation here. You can help the vets and help the candidates as well. you've got two candidates so far, and we've got 60 days left. How many more do you think you'll be able to affect in this situation?
Well, what we're doing is planning on supporting between 5 and 7
great
candidates in the closest races around the country. And you're right, we really do have a triple benefit. If you support us, not only are we going to get our message out of bringing the troops home, but we're going to support the candidate, and we're going to support an unemployed veteran as well.
Man, that's just a terrific idea. That really makes me feel good. I have you had good luck raising funds so far?
It's been okay. We just launched 2 weeks ago. We've gotten some funding in, but we still do need more, and any amount helps.
Okay. Okay, well, all right, we've got IraqVeteransForProgress.com or .org, either one.
That's right.
And they can donate there. There's probably a snail mail address or a credit card system they can use on there.
IraqVetsForProgress.org, and if you click on the donate button, you can donate online with a Visa or MasterCard or mail in a check.
Great, either way. Well, Tim, I wish you a lot of luck with this. I think this is a great, great idea. And like you said, man, it's just it's good for everybody. And it's number one, it's going to be good for America if we get the right candidates in there that have the right attitude about the war and try and make sure that this kind of crap doesn't happen again. I'm not anti-military at all. And I don't think most people against this war are anti-military. It's just using our military in the wrong fashion. It's certainly got me disturbed, and a lot of people, as you well know. Tim, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Okay, that's IraqVeteransForProgress.com or .org. Stop and take a look at their website. That's really a great idea. You know, I never thought about that. You know, the DNC... pays people to go out and work and candidates and volunteers as well. Who did we have the other day that had Tony Trupiano. Man, he had a slew of volunteers. I love it when people, you know, I am a volunteer, and I do help work in campaigns and so forth, and it's a doggone great thing to do. And man, there's nothing. For those of you that haven't done that, maybe some of your youngsters, some of you are youngsters, I know there's not too many young folks listening to the program, but my very first campaign, as I've told my listeners many, many times, was the Kennedy campaign. And I was in the, you know, Young Democrats for Kennedy, and started out, you know, working in the campaign headquarters back when we used to have the big old headquarters, you know, and they'd find a vacant building downtown and rent it. They still kind of do it that way. That's what our local club has done. But, you know, we had a big old building downtown, and I was 15 and started volunteering to do anything. And you swept the floors, you answered phones, you emptied the waste baskets, you knocked on doors, you made phone calls, you did everything you could. And I've often said that's pretty heady stuff when he stood there and made that great speech after being inaugurated. To know that you were a part of it. So you can be a part of things like that as well, and you should be. And I hope you will be. So, all righty then. We're at the bottom of the hour here right now. We started talking there before I got carried away about how these people are wanting to change the playing field again. Once again, it was the WMDs, and that didn't fly. And then we wanted to get democracy for the Iraqis, and that didn't fly. And so many things that they've tried to do. But one thing that we never heard, the word until just recently, and don't you find it interesting, like I was talking about before, a new name for this administration's old enemy, Islamofascist. Now, the first time I heard that, I have to admit, the first time I heard of it, it came out of the mouth of Pillboy, of Drug Boy, Limbaugh. Came out of his mouth the first time, Islamofascist. And there was no mention of that when we went into Iraq, certainly not. So, you know, it's been a late addition. And since the Bush administration has been so desperately trying to link Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden, one might have expected the fascist label to surface way back then. But no, there was no fascist remarks whatsoever. So my question is, When did the fascists arrive in Iraq, and where did they come from? Were they from that brand-new mysterious school of modern fascism located up in the mountains there between Afghanistan and our good friends up in Pakistan? You know, our Pakistani allies that have now told the world that Osama bin Laden will be safe in their country as long as he's a good boy and doesn't cause any trouble. So evidently, there's this new school of modern fascism up there in the mountains somewhere, turning out thousands of graduates indoctrinated in the new doctrine of Islamo-fascism. You must be able to get a course in that. You see, it wasn't even known to them until Rummy and Cheney and Junior Bush came up with the phrase a few weeks back, and the terrorists heard, and, you know, they said, damn, we really like that. So now you can get a degree in it at that new school. And there's some minor details to work out, though. You see, well, to be a real fascist, and I don't think Americans understand this, to be a real fascist, you have to be a nationalistic extremist. And none of the guys in Al-Qaeda really have any nationalistic tendencies that I can see. I don't see one damn one of them fighting for Afghanistan or fighting for good old Pakistan or fighting. No, they don't belong to or represent any nation state whatsoever. So they're a little bit perplexed as to how they can really be called fascist, but that's for them to work out. And just because the term Islamo-fascism doesn't fit them whatsoever is no reason for Junior Bush and his propagandists to stop using it. After all, it did work so nicely in stirring up the anti-Islamic fervor in our country. So why stop now? That's the way the Bushies always look at it. All of them, you know, the easily fooled, the very malleable voters who can't think for themselves but depend upon the Limbaughs and the Hannitys of the world to do their critical thinking for them, they'll accept it at face value, and they have. And they're using it liberally every chance they get. It's Islamo-fascism. there's a, you know, I always often talk about Ellie May, the local radio host here. They've got a website, and these people on there, you know, it's every other word, Islamo-fascist. I love the mindset of these people. But you hear it everywhere, and there is this local radio station here that is just Looney Tunes right wing 24/7, and their forum is using it a lot. And never once in the previous years that we've been monitoring that site has even one, not even one of the cretins who post on that forum ever used the term Islamo-fascist until this past month or so, when their gods, you know, Limbaugh and Hannity and Dennis Prager and Savage and Laura Ingraham and the rest of them started using it. And it's really funny. It is really, really funny. I've got a friend who also monitors that site for laughs, and we place bets back and forth as to when the Neanderthal thinkers on that site to start using this phrase or another that the Bushes want to push. I mean, it's a riot, and it's really a good hobby. They're such great independent thinkers, those neocons. So why the fascist terminology, you know, all of a sudden? Well, actually, I think it was Limbaugh that started it, and come to think of it, it might have been that Michael Wiener Savage. Actually, both of them started using it about the same week, as far as I can tell. It's kind of an odd affiliation, don't you think? Michael Wiener Savage and Rush Limbaugh. One of them's a drug-addled pathological liar, and the other one's a homophobe who lives in San Francisco. Anyway, I'm sure that that's where the term first popped up, and the Bushes, probably Karl Rove, started using it shortly thereafter. I mean, these guys stick together. And there are days that one might think Limbaugh's running the government. After some of the policies we see, that they must be coming from someone completely strung out on some sort of mind-altering drugs, and Limbaugh sure fills the bill on that one. I pick on him, don't I? But it's odd that the fascist term is now so popular, and they didn't have any luck with terrorists, and they didn't have any luck with insurgents or the jihadists or the radical Islamists. None of those stuck. Or any other dozen terms that they've tried to use. None of them seem to resonate with the public. So out comes fascist. Has a nice ring, doesn't it? After all, everyone has heard of fascist. And it's got a nice negative connotation. And so, shazam, bingo, all of a sudden they've hit on a winner. And finally, a word that the American public can all agree on. Now, I will bet you that half of the people who walk around this country right now using the word fascist have got no earthly idea what it really means. I'll bet you they don't. They don't know what it means, but they do know it's bad, so they use it. And I'm kind of disappointed they didn't use Commie Pinko. I always kind of like that one a lot, but it's fascist, it's stuck, and they'll stay with it until they think of something better. They really will. But I was thinking the other day that they haven't really scored big with this yet. They haven't got every last American right-wing voting stooge involved in it yet. So what they need to do, and I thought about this last night, what they need to do is get themselves a modern-day Joe McCarthy. And since there is someone who is a loyal devotee to Crazy Joe making the rounds on the right wing, we ought to approach Ann Coulter and see if she'll take the job. Just imagine hearing on TV, hunting down Islamo-fascists, searching through the entertainment industry and flushing them out and making them appear before Senate hearings and confess that they worship Allah. Man, what drama. What red meat for the neocons. And the man Coulter up there hurling insults at him, rapid-fire questions like, what would she ask him? McCarthy-style questions. Mr. Malik, are you now or were you ever observing prayers toward Mecca? Or do you place Muhammad ahead of Jesus? Do you secretly read the Quran? And do you believe the evils that it espouses? And where do you keep your terrorist materials such as bombs and RPGs and so forth? Or have you ever made a phone call to Pakistan? And they could get Rick Santorum and Orrin Hatch and that crazy Inhofe from Oklahoma and Joe Lieberman to be on the committee and have ABC cover it gavel to gavel every single day and maybe put it on pay-per-view. And the neocon right-wing Bush box would just go nuts. They'd stay home from work just to watch it. Every night they'd load up their pickup trucks with gangs of Bush lovers with shotguns and rifles, hunting down every Muslim person who dared be out after dark. Or better yet, they could revive that sacred old tradition they used so many years ago, or wearing those fancy white sheets and hoods and such. It would make such a perfect match, actually, because the folks with the sheets didn't like anyone of a different color, a different religion, or just different. Man, just think of the good time they'd have up in Detroit. So you think I'm over the line here? Maybe I'm accusing the right wing of being racist? You think I ought to apologize to them for being a bit tough on them? Well, when donkeys fly, racism abounds over on the right wing, and stupidity flourishes as well. And believe me, racism mixed with stupidity is a dangerous thing. And that's exactly what the Bush regime is counting on when they start throwing out round words like Islamo-fascist. That phrase is nothing more than hate-filled rhetoric designed to inflame the weak-minded among them to action. It's worked before, and it'll work again. It's up to us to snuff it out. And I intend to do my part. I do. Hey, let's go back to the phones. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Well, Guy, it's Dave in Eureka.
Hi, Dave.
So much enjoy your program every day. One of the things that I've learned, and I mean it's consistent, is that what the comms do, they then accuse their opponents of doing, even though the opponent didn't do it. If the cons throw a pie in the face of Santa Claus, they immediately scream, "This Democrat just threw a pie in the face of Santa Claus." Well, no, it was them that did it. In terms of religious fascism, it exists clearly among one group in this world right now, and it is not the Iraqis, it's not the Afghanistanis. They don't even know, they wouldn't have a hint of fascism over there. It is right here with our cons, and I've thought for a time that I'm pretty much knowledgeable about what's driving this thing, but I've been attending some seminars and groups here just in the last week, Monday, in front of our courthouse, and then just last night, a seminar in Arcata. And what's coming out more and more is the reality of 9-1-1, and also what's driving, what is behind this need for us to be in war in the Middle East. And it is very much this corporate fascist scheme that is driving it, for them to continue to escalate their profits at the rate that they intend. They needed their wars. That was just was a given. In order for them to be able to launder all the money, to switch the treasury, from the Treasury into the pockets of the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and the PNAC cons. They needed their war, and that was what was driving it. I learned some other things about 9/11. Apparently, bin Laden had virtually no part to play in it. He's always been a good boy, a friend of the Bushes, and willing to do what he could, but they weren't about to trust that day into the hands of some incompetent pilots that couldn't really fly a Cessna. The planes, as these people learned it, were steered by a remote control system by pilots on the ground, and the hijackers really had no idea of where they were going. They thought they were on a ride to Arabia. So, a lot of stuff I'm learning right now that is surprise on top of surprise. The authors that I listened to last night, Don Paul, he's got the book Waking Up from Our Nightmare, the 911 Crimes in New York City. They also had a DVD there entitled 911 Guilt, and I got to tell you, it was amazing. Then we had a long discussion after it, and everybody's a lot smarter today than we were last week. Anyway, I rambled on there a bit, aren't you?
Well, that's what it's about, is getting educated. You know, that's the biggest problem America's got right now. Everybody tunes into Katie Couric for 30 minutes at night, or is anybody tuning into Katie Couric, or whoever does the news, and whatever news they like to watch, and gets a little soundbite here, a little soundbite there, and they think they know about these subjects, and they don't.
No.
And that's the idea.
So many in America think, if what you're saying is true, wouldn't I be seeing that on every TV channel? Wouldn't I be reading that in every newspaper? And I know that ain't what's happening, not today, not in America today. Free press was something out of our history. We've still got a free speech TV, and we've still got little horn networks here and there, but for the most part, mainstream media is told, don't touch it. Don't go anywhere near that. We don't want you talking about election fraud. We don't want you talking about unanswered questions about 911. And they understand they can't do it, and they don't.
Well, it's sooner or later it seeps out, and it's starting to seep out. I'm hoping the public becomes a little more aware of the report that came out last Friday. Notice that it did come out on Friday afternoon, but it's starting to get around a little bit, and you know the truth.
I think the truth of 911 guy is blowing up all over the place. Little groups are forming and having their huddles, and like, my God, that's true. I never would have believed that. It's happening all over the place right now.
Well, we need to find the truth. And I've said it many times before, and you know this, Dave. I don't know what happened on 9/11. I don't know. I mean, I saw with my eyes what I saw, but I don't know what happened. And I hope before I'm gone that I find out exactly what happened. I want to know every last detail, but all I know is something happened, something terrible.
Well, I find for myself the evidence to be overwhelming that it's totally different than the official account. I think you'd have to agree with that. Certainly your buddy Mike Malloy, he saw a reality there. He saw that we were being lied to unmercifully, and they have to ask the question, why? Why do they feel the need to impound all the evidence and not let it back to us? That in itself tells me something.
Well, there's so many questions left unanswered, and if their side of it is true, why not just put it all out there? What have they got to lose? I mean, we already know we lost all those lives. We already know that it was a fantastic screw up somehow. Why not just lay it out there and get it over with? If their side of it's true, if it isn't, oh God help us.
Well, I don't think screw up's the word. It was very willful. They'd been planning for years to invade the Middle East. They tried to get Clinton to go along with it, and he told them to get out of his office. They tried in every way they could to get rid of him. They couldn't wait to steal the next election, get in and invade Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan. They did it, and they're on course. No, screw-up is not a word. Bungled up, no. They're incompetent, but they're doing what they plan to do. It's very much very, very profitable to this little special interest group of psychopaths, sociopaths that we have right now in office.
Well, I've yet to see them have any a human side. Oh, they have that that facade, that little facade that they hide behind, the curtain they hide behind to their face. I've seen no indication of any thought or compassion or love for their fellow human beings whatsoever. I mean, it's just not there.
Whatever decency we have been fortunate to have had in the past is totally absent now. They are just purely, how do we use you, what's in it for us?
And, that's right.
We'll step on you if it gets us an inch higher.
Dave, thanks for your call. Good to hear from you.
You do a wonderful program, Guy.
Thank
Stay
you.
With it, buddy.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Bye now. I don't know. So many things we could talk about today. We don't have a lot of time left in the program today, and I hate to get started on a real deep subject. I was going to talk a little bit about Bush's speech again the other night. I watched it again last night. Yes, I did. I know. Go ahead and throw rocks. I did. I watched it again last night. There's nothing... Those eyes are hollow. There's nothing back there. There's nothing there when he talks. He's some sort of a automatron, robot or something. He's got no. You can predict his mannerisms. They're always the same. They got the same little smirk, the same little hand gestures, the same little, you know, turn of the head here and there. Watch him giving a speech sometime in front of Congress or. No, you won't get to see him address Congress anymore, hopefully. Let's see, would he address Congress for anything? No, I don't think so anymore, no. Thank God. God, that's a... No, wait a minute. No, he's got one more State of the Union speech. Yeah, he sure does. He does. Okay. Well, you watch him next year when the State of the Union speech comes around, how he's his head, he looks like one of those Disney World... robots that they have sitting, you know, when you take that little jungle cruise and you go through there and those animals' heads are gradually turning. That's what he looks like. And somebody on the chat room says he's a zombie guy. That's exactly what he looks like. Exactly. They said, now be sure to move your head, Georgie, when you speak. And so, okay, I'll do it. I'll do it. And he does. He's well-schooled. He listens just like a good dog. He listens to everything he's supposed to do, and he goes out and does it, and looks like an ass doing it usually. Man, does he ever. Well, hey, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just a moment or two.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rush Limbaugh.
They say that I'm sleaze and elitist. You please, everybody disagrees with my rapping.
It's rap.
I'm horrendous. I'm appalling. My ratings now are falling because I'm so full of bull, so full of crap.
Full of crap.
With condescending tribes making money, selling lies. You might say everybody hates my guts.
Hates guts.
I'm offensive. I'm a bigot. I'm a fraud. Can you dig it? I'm a sexist, racist, homophobic, fat, pathetic tuts.
I'm not.
He's a Nazi.
That's right.
I really am,
because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class, because I'm a fat conservative butthead with the face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative butthead.
Hey,
with the face of a horse's ass.
I have a subhuman figure, a huge rear end. My brain? That's another story.
It's quite another story.
I have a face the size of a wash tub, and my ass is as big as Missouri.
Yes! This bastard is sick. He's a fat mom is big and his ass is as big as Missouri.
Yes, sir, we bob.
Manipulating statements exaggerate the truth. I can't believe they hate my show. Inspires. It's not just because I'm stupid. It's not just because I'm scum. It's just because Republicans are liars. I am heartless. I am vain, insensitive, insane. They say that I'm a national disgrace. I am nasty, insulting, basically revolting. I'm a concentrated pile of human waste. Because I'm a Nazi.
Heil!
I really am,
because I'm a Nazi.
That's right.
You're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class.
I'm a sick Republican sleazeball with a face of a horse's ass.
He's a sick Republican sleazeball with a face of a horse's ass.
They say that this is not about my vanity. They doubt my sanity. They think I'm nuts.
So nuts.
I am a cyst on the ass of humanity.
Ew.
New Republican slogan, read my pets. From the bowels of
Adolf
Hitler comes the voice of Rush Limbaugh. In closing, let me say that each and every day, I'm an evil, rotten, egotistical snob.
Evil, rotten.
I'm the capo, the capo, Joe McCarthy-like Gestapo, the right-wing, foam-at-the-mouth, jack-booted slob, the democratic trashin', years of liberal bashing with the equivalent compassion of a grommet. With the IQ of a fig, I'm the fat, obnoxious pig. And the truth of the matter is, I'm vomit. Because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
Hi, I really am, because I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
Hi, you're being scammed.
I'm a Nazi.
He's a Nazi.
I don't care about the middle class, because I'm a fear-mongering scumbag with a face of a horse's ass.
He's a fat conservative butthead.
Hey, Republican sleazeball. Fear-mongering scumbag.
Oh.
Egotistical asswipe.
Yes.
Mean-spirited, hog-wallering fat conservative tots.
With the face
of a horse's ass.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
Oh, it's true.
Call Guy James now, 1-866-546-5254.
Hey, you got a couple of minutes to call the program yet. If you like, 866-546-5254. Just noticed that Kukla the Wonder Dog came walking in from the outer office here. I always leave the door cracked a little bit in the studio so that she can, when she comes in the building with me, why she can make her way into the studio. She usually likes to stay out there. Big guard dog, you know, this Yorkie, all of 6 pounds. Just absolutely ferocious. Yes, Kukla the Wonder Dog. And for all of you that write and ask every time I say that, Kukla means doll in Greek. So there you have it. Famous dog. Famous dog. Absolutely ferocious. We live not far from some neighbors that, well, of course, if they're neighbors, you don't live far away. That was kind of stupid, wasn't it? That have a couple of dachshunds. And what's those dachshunds' name? Jetta and Mercedes. And, man, that little Yorkie hears those dogs go out for their walk in the evening and just goes nuts. Got to get out there and meet and have their little social time, you know. It's cute. It really is, these two dachshunds and this crazy Yorkie. Oh, well. That's not very political, is it? But we don't always have to talk about that on the program. It's been an interesting day today. And I do want to thank you for all the comments we got about Mozambique. Do read that book. If your library does, I don't know if your library would have it or not. I know it's a big seller. So, this one will be shipped out soon. We need a one free book today. We gave away, I'm telling the studio audience here, give away a free book today, and so we'll send that out. But every American should be made to know that story. Should be made to. Every right-wing asshole who thinks all this rendition and the torture and all that's all, and they should all have to know that story. They should all have to sit and listen to how he was taken away from his family for 3 years. A man guilty of absolutely nothing. Nothing. Can't even come to the United States. I'm not sure he wants to after the treatment he got. And notice the worst treatment he got. The worst treatment he got. In those horrible prisons was by the Americans. The Pakistanis, when they first got him, they treated him with respect. Even the British treated him very well. It's when the Americans got a hold of him. And I'm not laying the blame on the American soldier there. I'm not. I'm laying the blame square right where it belongs, on our government, on our Department of Defense, for allowing that sort of thing to happen. It's something that's sickening to the average American, and every American should know it. It's just like after the atrocities of the Holocaust after the Second World War, how they made the German people go in there and see the death camps. And the American people should have to see some of the things that's going on in the name of the American people right now. Not in my name. Not in my name. Well, I want to thank you very much for listening to the program today. We'll be back with you again Tuesday. We'll have a replay on tomorrow, another one on Monday. We'll be back Tuesday. And for all of you that are sending all the emails saying, when are you going to go back to 5 days live again? We're working on it. We're working on it. We are. It takes money to do that. And this is a listener-supported program. I hope you remember that. You can head on over to the website, theguyjamesshow.com, and throw a nickel in the drum. We'd appreciate it. But that would help. We are proud.